Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Force, the Dark Side, the Jedi, the Empire, Chewbacca. It's all back this week with the release of Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens. And it got us asking, what is Star Wars? Science fiction, fantasy, myth, epic space opera, spaghetti western? And where does it stand in the sprawling realm of space fiction, movies, novels, and more? From Jules Verne to 2001, A Space Odyssey to Spaceballs. This hour on Point, Star Wars and its place in the pantheon of space fiction. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Did you see Star Wars last night? What did you think? What works for you when stories go into space? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And by the way, we are tooting our horn this week. iTunes just named the On Point podcast to its best of 2015. That means best in the universe. It's a great way to listen or catch up if you miss a broadcast. Subscribe at iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. You can link to all that at our website, onpointradio.org. Okay, to infinity or Tatooine and beyond. With us now from Baltimore is Anne Hornaday, film critic for The Washington Post, ready for launch, we hope. Anne Hornaday, welcome back to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be here.
Great to have you. From Milwaukee, Jerry Canavan joins us, professor of English and science fiction maven at Marquette University. Jerry Canavan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
And from New York, Forrest Wickman is here, senior editor at Slate. His essay this week, Star Wars is a Postmodern Masterpiece. Forrest Wickman, welcome to you as well.
Hello, Tom.
Let's get right to it. Here's a little bit, Episode 7, The Force Awakens, Han Solo, Harrison Ford, and Chewbacca, played by Peter Mayhew.
Chewie, we're home.
Okay, we're going to put it in a big context, David. Anne, first just take us to the film. I regret I have not been able to see it yet. I will. You say it gets the nostalgia novelty mix just right. What did you see on the screen this time, Anne?
Well, I think for my purposes, I saw a return to first principles. You know, I saw a film that really reclaims a lot of the ground that had been lost in the dreary middle prequel years that I think we can all agree were not the finest hour of the franchise. And I think what J.J. Abrams has done, as you just heard, he brings back the several of the original players, which is gratifying. And then he's added characters and cast members who are brand new, melds the two. So I think it was really less an exercise in, breaking anything open in terms of film language or even the universe of the actual mythos, but he just kind of set it to rights and then teed everything up for the next few films to take it forward, and I hope what will be really innovative ways.
Forrest, we're back in the mythos here with Star Wars. It had some pretty dreary interim manifestations. You've seen the new one. What do you say, Forrest?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that, you know, what J.J. Abrams really specializes in is coming to franchises and properties like this and knowing how to kind of please fans by, following most of the rules and then twisting them just enough that it feels fresh. I wish that the new movie took a few more risks, but, you know, generally I thought it did a fantastic job of creating the spirit of the original movies, and I just found it very satisfying.
I mean, a lot of people look at Star Wars and they go back to Buck Rogers, 1930s and 40s, the sort of push back against the rise of Hitler and fascism and all the rest. You got the stormtroopers there, but you call it a postmodern masterpiece. Why postmodern, Forrest?
Yeah, I mean, I think when we talk about Star Wars now, it's easy to see that 1977 movie as the origin of, you know, five, now six movies since then, you know, countless TV shows and books and lunchboxes and toys and so on. At the time when it came out, it played more as kind of a remix of everything that came before. Time magazine called it a subliminal history of the movies. And so, yeah, when George Lucas set out to create it, one of his first thoughts was to try to remake Flash Gordon. But then when he couldn't get the rights, because actually Fellini owned them, he just started bringing in all these other elements from Akira Kurosawa samurai movies and, you know, John Ford Westerns and even a little bit of Casablanca. So it really played much more kind of like it's different in some ways, but more like a Tarantino movie. It was kind of a Tarantino movie before Tarantino in some ways.
It's called a pastiche of all that, but it had a lot of drive right at the beginning. Many saying that's coming back, and Hornaday says it's coming back this time. Here's a clip from the new one. The Force Awakens, Supreme Leader Snoke, played by Andy Serkis, and Kylo Ren, new bad guy, played by Adam Driver.
There's been an awakening. Have you felt it? Yes. Even you have never faced such a test.
Jerry Canavan in Milwaukee, there's been an awakening. Have you felt it, sir?
Yes, I saw it last night. Loved it.
Why? Why this time? And were you one of those back in the Jar Jar days who was alienated and not ready to stay on board, but back now?
Oh, 100%. The prequels were a disappointment for a lot of us. I grew up on the films, loved them as a kid. But this one really recaptures the magic. And I watched them, you know, as the kid who'd been waiting since 1983 to see these movies continue, but also as the father of a three-year-old girl. And that part of the movie to me is just incredible. The character played by Daisy Ridley is amazing. And it's touching to me that this gets to be her Star Wars. So, whatever else you might want to say about plot holes or retreading the previous movies, J.J. Abrams has my heart for that forever.
Anne Hornaday, we're going to go to where this sits in the big pantheon of space fiction, but walk us through, if you would, Anne, the old characters who have returned and how they do here, and the new characters and how they play.
Okay, well, I'm going to keep it kind of vague because I know a lot of people still haven't seen it, and I take it, you know, the spoiler culture has gotten a little out of control, but I do respect people's the joy of discovering something on your own. But I don't think it's giving away too much to say that, yes, Harrison Ford and Carrie Fisher and Mark Hamill are back, as well as C-3PO and R2-D2. And I think one of the triumphs of this movie actually is Harrison Ford. I mean, rather than a sort of condescending little cameos where everybody's patted on the head and then told to go home, you know, just for fan service, I mean, he's really an integral part, and so does Carrie Fisher, for that matter. They really have very substantive roles in this film, and he is just a joy. I mean, he kind of recaptures that same gruff, sardonic Han Solo loner.
I got a little bit of that right here, Anne, a clip from the Force Awakens with Harrison Ford, Han Solo against Maz Kanata, played by Lupita Nyong'o.
The dark side. A Jedi.
It's calling to you.
Sorry, that's very trailery, but he's jumping around. He's got a lot of energy. Everybody likes Harrison Ford back. What about Carrie Fisher as now what, General Leia?
She's wonderful, too, and their relationship is just terrific to watch them working together again. And then, as Jerry said, I was also extremely gratified by Daisy Ridley's character. I mean, I just think she and John Boyega both, they just delivered absolutely electrifying, intense, but funny and just easy. They have an easy rapport. And
They're playing who here, Anne?
Okay, let me just see. She plays a scavenger named Ray.
Mm-hmm.
And then Boyega plays, I'm just going to say,
yeah,
he plays a soldier. I'm not going to go into any detail about
fine,
what side
okay,
he's on.
Okay, okay, okay.
And I won't tell you how, you know, people get together and things happen. But just it is. It is just so, especially the year that we, you know, that Hunger Games kind of wrapped up, and now we have this new heroine who kind of takes up the mantle of a Katniss Everdeen, of just this strong, super competent, very likable and appealing female character. Is really cool.
What about the bad guy here? I've got a little clip right here, again from the trailer, sorry, but this is the new bad guy in Black Mask, Kylo Ren, played by Adam Driver. Seems he's speaking here to the ghost of Darth Vader.
Nothing will stand in our way. I will finish what you started.
New kind of Black Mask, new actor, what do you say? Anne?
For me?
Yes.
I thought he did a terrific job. I mean, he, you know, as you can tell, that's a that has to be a vocal performance, among other things, and I think he has the voice for it, and that, that kind of exotic look that we're, I think he's a wonderful actor anyway. And then we should also mention Oscar Isaac. I mean, some of these people, like Adam Driver and John Boyega and Oscar Isaac, you know, critics, we know these guys because we've seen the little indies that they've done. We've kind of watched them throughout their career, but this will be the first time that mass audiences might see these people, or at least associate them with, you know, with a persona, and they just acquit themselves beautifully.
Forrest Wickman, when Jules Verne started dreaming stories up into space, do you think he would have imagined that we'd have something like Star Wars a century and more on?
Oh, I don't really think you could. I mean, to me, you know, you can talk about Star Wars's place in science fiction and space fiction. I don't think of Star Wars as being certainly science fiction quite as much. It obviously has, you know, spaceships and lasers and things. But, you know, at its heart, it's a kind of more of a fantasy movie and an adventure that's not spending all of its time kind of giving warnings about the future or anything like that.
We are fascinated with stories set in space, and there have been many. We're going to dive into that realm with Forrest Wickman of Slate. Jerry Canavan is with us from Marquette, and Hornaday from the Washington Post. A little music behind us here from Flash theme, Flash Gordon by Queen. They did the theme to the 1980 Flash Gordon movie. Of course, it's a lot older than that. You can join us. Did you line up at the cinema last night to see Star Wars? What's your review? Thumbs up. And among all the great stories set in space, what flavor of space story is Star Wars? What's your favorite flavor? 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. We're headed to Tatooine and beyond. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Though the music may tell you otherwise, we are talking about Star Wars this hour and its place in the pantheon of space fiction, space movies, and more. Of course, that Star Trek theme behind us right there, and there are so many in this realm. You can join us this hour. Have you seen the latest from Star Wars? What do you make of it? And what's your favorite story in the genre of space fiction? Star Wars, Star Trek, 2001, the Foundation series, Alien, Avatar, WALL-E, I don't know, Spaceballs. It even gets funny out there. Anne Hornaday is with us, film critic for The Washington Post. She's seen and written about the new Star Wars. So have Jerry Canavan. He's a professor at Marquette, specializes in science fiction and popular culture there. And Forrest Wickman, senior editor at Slate, who wrote the piece, Star Wars is a Postmodern Masterpiece. Of course, it all goes back to the beginning and The Empire Strikes Back. We know what happens there. Well, you know these guys. Here, let's just dive in. Vader and Luke Skywalker.
Obi-Wan never told you what happened to your father.
He told me enough. He told me you killed him.
No. I am your father.
And boom, we're in the realm of Oedipus and what, Joseph Campbell and hero journeys and all the rest, but there are many ways to go to space. Here's a clip from 1968, 2001, A Space Odyssey. We know it.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave.
I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
Where does Star Wars sit in the realm of all that? Derek in Dayton, Ohio, have you seen the new movie? Thanks for calling, Derek.
I have, Tom. Yeah, I have seen the new movie. Saw it last night. And one thing I have to say is I'm really glad that J.J. Abrams went back with the look of the movie to kind of the trilogy. It's a very almost post-apocalyptic, very dirty, dingy. You see wrecked ships, and the weapons are used in secondhand, and we kind of went away with that with the, with the prequels. Very, very sleek, very new, very CGI computer look. Not that I didn't enjoy them, but we get back to this secondhand look for this new movie, and I like that. It gets back to the feel that this is a real world, that these weapons and these spaceships have been around for a long time.
Derek,
it really helped you sink into the story.
It sounds like you're really into it. When you look across the huge horizon of space fiction, if we can call it that, 2001 and Alien and Interstellar and Star Trek and Avatar, or all that, how do you see Star Wars? Does space really matter for Star Wars, or could it just as well be set in the Aegean Sea?
Well, I mean, you see, the very first thing you see in any Star Wars movie is a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. And I think that the fact that one thing we forget is that this supposedly is happening, you know, in history is a long time ago. And to answer your question, yeah, I do think being in a galaxy far, far away is the most important thing. I mean, it's called Star Wars. You know, it could be Sea Wars, it could be, you know, Earth Wars, but it's Star Wars. It takes place in space, and I think that those characters have a certain grandeur to them because it takes place in this otherworldly existence.
Derek, I love your call, and I appreciate it. Jerry Canavan, is that the trick right there by putting space fantasy fiction way in the past? I mean, space was so associated with the future for most thinkers and writers for a long time. Star Wars puts it in the past, and is that what gives it the passkey to all these old forms of literature?
There may be something to that. It's coming at a time when we start to get pessimistic about outer space. The space program kind of peters out. We stop going to the moon. We stop believing that that's our future. And so Star Wars kind of revitalizes that by giving it this more mythic quality, this lived-in quality that one could actually imagine. Able to tell a story about outer space that's a little bit more pessimistic than something like Star Trek, but not grim, right? That there still has hope and really taps into those mythical qualities that you're mentioning.
Of course, Star Trek was all about hope. It was set definitely in the future. Here's a bit from 1990, The Next Generation, Captain Picard, Patrick Stewart.
Attention, all hands. As you know, we could outrun the Klingon vessels, but we must protect the Enterprise C until she enters the temporal rift. And we must succeed. Let's make sure history never forgets the name. Enterprise. Picard out.
Star Trek, their first episode set in the year 2364. Star Wars set long, long ago. Ann Hornaday, how do you look at the Star Wars series up against, you know, the other giants of the sort of space movie genre, 2001? I mean, they're sprawling, they're all over the place, but you've got 2001 with a very, very different feeling, very high concept and not necessarily optimistic.
Oh, no, not at all. And I think what I gather is that with Star Wars, Lucas really, I mean, he had made a science fiction movie before, THX 1138, mm-hmm. which was more in that sort of dystopian tradition and very sleek I love Derek's observations about the used future aesthetic. And I almost think that Star Wars, I believe that at some point he said it was a Western set in space. That's really truly what he meant. I mean, he wanted to kind of, is sensing the pessimism of the era of the 70s, both in terms of the cinema and the culture at large. He wanted to create a throwback to the kind of optimistic, wholesome, idealistic narratives of his childhood, which is where the Flash Gordons of the world come in. And then, of course, the Kurosawa is the film student in him, you know? So mm-hmm. I think it was, as Forrest has noted, it's a mashup of his own impulses. And I think he wanted to give the young generation of the 70s something hopeful and optimistic like he had. So really, rather than kind of a meditation and a new visual language that Kubrick created with 2001, this was almost a response to it, and it was using that the space piece and the science fiction piece is more of a backdrop than the actual language of the film.
I mean, space is somehow always been a liberating stage setting. You could make things almost whatever you pleased in space because it was out there. It was different. People talk a lot about Flash Gordon. Here's just a scene from 1936. Flash Gordon, Earthlings visit planet Mongo to stop the planet from running into Earth.
It's so desolate.
Yes, but that city proves it's inhabited.
We must go there at once. We're losing valuable time. This planet may crash into the Earth at any moment.
Yes. Well, what about the rocket ship?
I have it securely locked.
Good.
Flash Gordon with tight shots of lizards to stand in for aliens. I mean, Forrest, what about the freedom that the space setting gives to creatives?
Yeah, I mean, I think Lucas really kind of threw out the rule book when making these movies. You mentioned, you know, the A Long, Long Time Ago in a Galaxy Far, Far Away opening text. And he, you know, way back in 1975, he was saying in interviews very consciously that that was his way of making it a fairy tale, just like saying Once Upon a Time. And just about that, the great comment about how the old movies kind of feel used. They have a secondhand quality to them. That's actually quite literal. I mean, it borrowed a lot from 2001, A Space Odyssey. Many of the effects artists came straight from that movie. They called them the class of 2001 when they were working on Star Wars. But it had a much lower budget than 2001. And so they literally just took a lot of junk from other movies. So something like the lightsaber, for example, is made from a camera flashbulb, the handle is.
And Star Wars, just one of so many set in space. David in New York, Williamsville, New York. David, thanks for calling. You're on.
Thanks. Hi, kids. Anyway, I just have to say I've enjoyed Star Wars, but I have never loved it as I have Aliens or Blade Runner or Frank Herbert's Dune series. I think it's Star Wars is more like a young adult novel or a romance novel. There's really a very valuable place for it, but it's not as pithy as I like in space fantasy.
So give you Dune, give you Blade Runner or Alien. Appreciate your call, David. Jerry, what about it? I mean, Forrest says straight up, this is not science fiction, which separates it from so much of what we see in space movies, space fiction. Do you agree Star Wars is not science fiction? And how do you see it in the context of this whole genre and the kind of, there's a lot of really heavy stuff that comes out of stories told in space.
Yes, in terms of the original three, it really is a kind of fairy tale about good wizards beating the evil wizards and kind of restoring, hope and goodness. It's really in the supplementary material, in the books and the comics and the video games, that you start to see a more science fictional world develop, where you start to wonder, well, what would happen if you assassinated the leader of a galactic empire and had one big victory? And the books play this out over decades. They're fighting the empire, trying to work this out. It becomes a kind of serious projection of what this would be like, really only in the supplementary material. That's all been kind of decanonized now by the new movie, but it takes up a similar point of view in that, you know, it wasn't a fairy tale happy ending for these people. They've had to go on living their lives for the next 30 years, and it hasn't always been happy for them. And I think that's really interesting. I think Star Wars is more science fictional because of The Force Awakens than it was just at the end of Return of the Jedi.
But doesn't it seem that Star Wars in many ways is just about human nature, whereas we've seen attempts in other space fiction, if we can call it that, Jerry, to look at a kind of bigger cosmology here, look at the other, imagine ways of existing that were not human.
Absolutely. This is a very kind of human story. What he really is exploring, especially as the series goes on, are tough questions about violence and nonviolence and about forgiveness. They become, you know, the spirituality of the Force becomes a really important part of this, something like the way religion or God functions in the works of J.R.R. Tolkien, Lord of the Rings, right? We start to really worry about spiritual questions as the series goes on. And that's the end of Return of the Jedi is almost like nothing else. Right, where suddenly the villain we've been fighting for movie upon movie turns out to be a father we need to make immense with. It's an intense and very strange story for this kind of blockbuster to choose. It ends in a totally unexpected way that's really interesting.
Go back to the climactic scene of the 77 original here, and the Force is all over.
Use the Force, Luke. Let go, Luke.
The Force is strong in this one.
Luke, trust me.
Joe in Boston, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Okay, what do you see?
I'm a big fan of science fiction in general, but it's kind of like I think there needs to be a distinction of, so Star Wars and Star Trek are, you know, movies and TV shows, but like Star Wars is more of a popcorn movie, and it has a huge universe, and it's been, you know, developed over the years and stuff like that. But then you have things like, what you call hard science fiction, where it asks the hard questions, space is not nearly as nice or as easy to move around in. So things like Battlestar Galactica, the remake, is much grittier, much more realistic. You know, and the TV show is also, TV shows can reflect, current events like fears of terrorism, things like that. Movies are, they're escapism.
But surely there have been movies which ask some tougher questions in a science fiction vein than Star Wars. Forrest, if you really want to get sci-fi in space movies, where do you turn for the? I mean, of course, 2001 is right there. What else do you put high on your list?
Alien has come up. That's definitely very high up there for me. And I think I would disagree with the caller just a little bit that you can draw quite so clean a distinction between, TV having the ability to go political and movies never going there. I mean, certainly we still have things like Guardians of the Galaxy. I think that was about a year ago now, a Marvel movie, and it's very much kind of a fantasy movie, popcorn flick in the vein of Star Wars. But then we also have recently had movies like Gravity and The Martian that get quite realistic, The Martian is a movie that's very concerned with our future. Also something like Interstellar that has a very strong environmental message, or even something like District 9, which doesn't take in place in space, but uses a metaphor about aliens to kind of deliver a message about how we otherize other groups, and specifically a message about racial segregation in South Africa. So I think the movies can still have a real message to them.
And as a movie critic, when you hear that a film is set in space, mm-hmm. Now some are just going to be like Apollo 13. They're essentially just going to be sort of a fictionalized tellings of reality. But when it's got that edge of either science fiction or fantasy to it, are there certain assumptions that come into your sort of anticipation of a film set in space?
That's a great question. I mean, I think, yes, these do have sort of their genre conventions that are obeyed, which I think Gravity, that was a really great example of one that took some of those conventions and pushed them even further. Mm-hmm. And just in terms of just the photography and the experience that it gave the viewer. Every genre has those sets, that language that, when is it a trope and when is it a cliche? That's kind of the perennial questions about these things. When does somebody just sort of resort to the usual, and then when does someone actually redefine something and push it forward?
Of course, you can have fantasy set right on Earth, but as soon as you leave the earthly realm, there's a kind of anything goes potential. I mean, if aliens show up, they can be any way they wish to be, Anne.
Absolutely, and you're right. I mean, it's incredibly liberating, and so then you have to kind of pay close attention to the logic, that the film, the artist is setting up, and whether or not the artist obeys his or her own logic, and you do have to be attentive to those things. But on first viewing, I mean, I'm sure it is. Star Wars being an example, if I went back and sort of picked it apart, I could see little holes, but most of it is just the actual experience that it gives you.
Anne Hornaday with the Washington Post, please stand by. Gary Canavan at Marquette, Forrest Wickman with Slate. We're talking about Star Wars and its place in the pantheon of space fiction, space movies, Listeners, you can join us when a movie moves to space. What freedoms does it find there? What constraints? 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about Star Wars and its place in the pantheon of space fiction, space movies, television, novels. I don't know if it's in the pantheon, but there's a little Lost in Space theme right there from 1998 film based on the 1960s television series. Anne Hornaday is with us today, film critic for The Washington Post. Jerry Canavan is with us from Marquette University. It looks at science fiction and popular culture there. And Forrest Wickman is with us, senior editor at Slate. His recent essay, Star Wars is a Postmodern Masterpiece. You can join us. What's the magic of fiction set in space? Do you like your space stories based in hard science, something like science, or straight-up fantasy? What's your favorite in the genre? So many flavors. Here's a clip from the BBC's 1973 radio drama based on Isaac Asimov's The Foundation trilogy. Later became a long series. This is an entry in the famed Encyclopedia Galactica about one of the main characters, Harry Seldon, who develops a way to predict the future.
Encyclopedia Galactica, 116th edition. Entry, Harry Seldon. Born the 11,988th year of the Galactic Era. Died 12,069. Birthplace, Helicon, Arcturus sector. He showed amazing ability in mathematics at a very early age.
Flash forward 1979, Sigourney Weaver, of course, so big in the Alien movies. Here's a scene where the Captain Dallas is in the ventilation shafts attacked by the alien.
Move, get out of there!
Things get tough in space in Alien. Bob in Norfolk, Virginia. Thank you for calling, Bob. You're on the air.
Tom, how are you doing today?
Pretty well. What do you see, Bob?
But what I see in a lot of these space movies is, and I could be wrong, but I'm looking for an opinion here from your panel and you, it's a good sense of religious allegory that goes on, especially Old Testament allegory, not so much a Christ-like figure, but prophets coming to save people, to take them to the promised land. Some make it, some don't. And especially in the Star Wars now septet of movies that they have out there, and I haven't seen the latest one as yet, but Han Solo, a reluctant prophet, Leia and Luke, certainly people who are going to lead people into a promised land of sorts, and I'm just wondering what the thought is of allegorism in this.
Religious allegory in Star Wars, maybe more widely once we get into space. Jerry, it's not the first time you get religious allegory. You get it in really science fiction, more true science fiction stories as well in space. How about in Star Wars?
Well, a lot of traditional science fiction stories actually frame themselves as anti-religion, right? Mm-hmm. Like Star Trek tended to. Harry Seldon has a scientific way to tell the future that replaces religious knowledge and religious prophecy. In Star Wars, you really see religion coming back as a possibility, right? That could be compatible with outer space, right? Or that something we need in outer space. And that's an important part of the mythos, what makes it function as a series.
What do you see in 2001 A Space Odyssey when it comes to this rejection or acceptance of something religious in the mystery?
Yeah, in 2001, it's an interesting counterpoint because we have this sense that there's been something quasi-divine that's kind of sparked human evolution, that's kind of pushed us forward into some new mode, and at the end of the movie is pushing the main character again into some new mode. But it doesn't seem spiritual or transcendent, right? It still seems to be part of a kind of materialist order. The Force is different, right? The Force is something that isn't material, right? That doesn't respond to that logic. That's one of the things people drove people nuts about the prequels, right? Is that he tried to turn it into something you could do a blood test for, right? That's not how it's supposed to function.
Yeah, we got Scott writing to us online here saying, I like that the Force is back to bring something more natural and spiritual, not just a gizmo found in someone's blood that can make them a Jedi. Right on that line. Eli in Waltham, Massachusetts. Eli, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to speak to Star Wars' relationship with Japanese culture and with Japanese influence, because George Lucas talked a lot about how much Kurosawa influenced him in making the first Star Wars movie.
Absolutely. And you brought it up right off the bat. I mean, Kurosawa, the great samurai filmmaker, love his work front to back. And George Lucas very much influenced by that. Do you see it again this time out in the hands of J.J. Abrams?
You know, I am not. I have to admit my paucity. I'm not a samurai you know, I didn't really see explicit, other than just having it be already in the DNA of Star Wars. I didn't see it being.
And you've got swords or sabers anyway. That's a start.
Absolutely, and that folds right into these aspects that Jerry's been discussing too. I mean, that's part of that. It's kind of a spiritual discipline. That's being awakened and sort of taken on, but no, I didn't see it being particularly overemphasized, you know, overmuch. But it's there. It's definitely. I think that was one of those things that has been restored. I think
sometimes we go to samurai land. Sometimes we go to spirituality. Sometimes it's very kind of worldly exploits in space. James Cameron's 2010 movie Avatar.
Killing the indigenous looks bad, but there's one thing that shareholders hate more than bad press, and that's a bad quarterly statement. I didn't make up the rules, so just find me a carrot that'll get them to move. Otherwise, it's going to have to be all stick.
Shareholders and quarterly statements, Forrest Wickman. I mean, it's just kind of a corporate critique way out somewhere in space.
Yeah, and there's another very strong element in Avatar that you also see in the Star Wars movies where, frankly, it begins to feel a lot like Vietnam. And
yes.
James Cameron and George Lucas were both right of that generation. James Cameron started to make movies. I believe he was a truck driver before Star Wars came out, and then Star Wars came out, and he realized he really needed to get on it. And George Lucas took what he had started to write into Apocalypse Now, which he had been working on, and it kind of filtered its way into Star Wars, where you had this technologically extremely advanced empire, which he, in his notes, equated directly with America, going up against a kind of much smaller, less technologically advanced rebellion, which, you know, eventually prevails through kind of ambush tactics and things like that.
And then we hear the chopper blades sound a little bit right there in Avatar, still that echo of the Vietnam dynamic. Let's go to New Orleans. Peter, thanks for calling, Peter. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Yes. For me, I saw the new Star Wars movie, and for me, I actually went all the way from seeing Episode 1 to Episode 7 at the theater with a bunch of people. And my aesthetic, though, is when I looked at it, I don't see so much the Vietnam aspect. I see more of a World War II version of it with the Empire. Because, I mean, even if you look at the uniforms of the Imperials, they call them Stormtroopers, and they actually have like kind of a fascist look about the officer uniforms. And I kind of saw the Alliance as, you know, the allies against the Empire.
I mean, people have picked up on that for a long time as well. There's sort of maybe an overlay here. There's a Vietnam mismatch in power, but there's also definitely in the Stormtrooper that very, very explicit kind of reference to fascist armies and World War II. I mean, Jerry, I guess the space can pick up on any element it likes out of earthly history, present or imagined future, and there's the screen of the universe to project it on.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's been a very popular meme going around this week about Luke Skywalker as a jihadi, right? His parents are killed by a by an attack. So he's brought into this kind of radical religion and ultimately perpetuates a terrorist attack on a major military installation, right? So it's just so free-flowing as an allegory. It can kind of comment on so many different aspects of our world. And what's interesting, as Forrest was just saying, is how often America or Western power seems to be framed as the villain in this, right? And our sympathy is actually with the person who's resisting the military-industrial complex. That was very important to Lucas as he made all of the early movies.
And how do you make of the way Americans flock to embrace this, even if it was a kind of veiled critique of the big power, the empire?
Well, you know, that goes back to even when science fiction sort of had a huge resurgence in the 50s. And, of course, then the allegory was Cold War. You know, then it was about invasion and infiltration and all of those sort of, the anxieties and impulses of every age are kind of folded into this elastic form, right, that can be, as Jerry's been explaining, it's sort of endlessly possible. And I think it's sort of, I don't know, it's I guess it provides a safe space to sort of work all this out, whether regardless of what particular persuasion you're coming from.
Or try and find what it is you want to fight for. Here's a clip from the latest. This is Finn, played by John Boyega, doesn't know what to fight for.
I was raised to do one thing. But I've got nothing to fight for.
Brent in Canton, Ohio. Brent, you're on the air. What do you see?
Well, I just want to mention that if you're going to be discussing the spiritual, philosophical aspects of the first movie, Episode 4, it's worth mentioning the extent to which it seems to borrow from the Shaolin Chan tradition of Buddhism. Those are, the Kung Fu monks, in the sense that the Force maps very well to Qi, and they used their fighting as a form of moving meditation. And that seems to, again, map very well to what the Jedi did. And I think there was a lot written at the time when the movie first came out, or at least some. Lucas was, in fact, borrowing from that tradition.
So much of Earth moving into space, even their Kung Fu and Qi, the Shaolin tradition, it's very easy to see that reference when they start talking about the Force, no question about it. Brent, I appreciate your call. Let me get one more right here from Mike in Milford, Massachusetts. Mike, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to comment about the big distinguishing factor between science fantasy and science fiction. And I think what that comes down to is being tied to the Earth history. So if any Earth history or human history is tied into it, the show or the movie instantly becomes science fiction. If it has nothing to do with the Earth or the Earth history or the laws of physics in our earthly world, it instantly becomes science fantasy.
Well, I mean, we share physics with the rest of the universe, though. But if by that definition, where do you put Star Wars?
So I would say Star Wars would be science fantasy, and Star Trek would be science fiction. And I say that we think that way in our heads. And because just like you can go to Lord of the Rings, that becomes science fantasy because it's a world we don't think of outside of human history.
Then Star Trek ties back to Earth in all kinds of ways. Once you get into the knot of that story. Forrest, how do you make a sharp distinction, science fiction and otherwise, when it comes to Star Wars? You say it's outside that realm. How do you draw the line, Forrest?
Yeah, I think the rule of thumb the caller just proposed is a pretty good one. You know, there's always exceptions. I think I would still call Guardians of the Galaxy a fantasy movie. For example, even though it kind of starts, blasts off from Earth. And the reason I say that is, to me, the main distinction is whether I think that science fiction is really concerned with kind of the practical concerns of today and making warnings about the future. And I don't think that that's particularly what something like Star Wars or Guardians of the Galaxy is really interested in, whereas something like The Martian is drawing a very clear and science-based line between today and the future and where it thinks things really are going, rather than just kind of imagining a whole separate universe that doesn't really have to be connected to ours.
Jerry, you're there at Marquette talking with young people born, most of them, well after the first Star Wars movie 40 years ago now. Do you pull Star Wars into your science fiction discussions or not?
Oh, absolutely. We look at, I have a 21st century science fiction class, and we look at Return of the Sith as this, strange revision of the original trilogy. How much sadder the story seems when you begin to expand it out past just the heroic adventures of Luke and Han and Leia, how long the galaxy seems to have been faced with these problems and how insurmountable they seem, which to me really reflects a kind of mood of pessimism of our time, right? We're less certain about the possibilities of the future than we were, and looking for hope. And again, that's one of the things I love about The Force Awakens is it tells a sad story in some ways, but it's not a grim story. It's a hopeful story. And that seems to be a division with a lot of the other types of space epics we've been having for the last couple of decades.
And Hornaday, what mood, what vision do you see in the latest here, The Force Awakens?
Very much the same, exactly what Jerry just said. I mean, it's not like it's just a happy-go-lucky, you know, skippity-doo-dah tale, but it does leave you in this kind of, it's a very buoyant film. And one of the sort of lingering effects of it for me when I saw it the other day was I realized I was smiling. It just sort of leaves you feeling good. It's kind of, it really does return to those core Lucas values of optimism and wholesome good cheer that that he started with.
Well, it worked at the beginning, and it may work again now. Certainly, First Returns looked like it. There it sits. Not even science fiction. My guests kind of concur today, but so strong in the genre of space stories, stories set in space anyway. Anne Hornaday at the Washington Post, we always love hearing from you. Film critic there, thank you very much for being with us today on the Star Wars front, Anne.
Thank you.
Jerry Canavan at Marquette University with us from Milwaukee. Thanks so much, Jerry.
Happy to do it.
And Forrest Wickman, senior editor at Slate. Forrest, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. This was fun.
Listeners, thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.